So here are some tips about how do we get that change talk. And some of these Terry was doing on the tape. First one is exploring the current situation or the client's point of view. This is a lot of what we talked about yesterday. You know, getting into their head, understanding their motivations, their ambivalence, their concerns, their point of view. These other strategies, I'm just going to hit a few highlights here. Looking backward is a strategy that we use when we suspect that there's been an escalating pattern of use over time that the person may be somewhat unconscious of. You know, I mean, the typical pattern might be somebody starts out and they're just sort of experimenting socially with drugs or drinking, and they're not intending to become addictive. They think that's just fun. They're just trying it out. For some folks, that then progresses to frequent use. And for some other folks, a smaller set, that progresses to problem use, you know, which can be abuse or dependence. People don't start out thinking, you know, well, gee, if I smoke pot one more time, I'm going to cross the line into dependence. You know, they just don't think about it that way. And so the looking backward strategy is one in which you say, essentially, well, tell me about your drinking before it was a problem. Or tell me about your pot smoking before it was a problem. And you get them to actually give you a little bit of history of sort of what the pattern of use was, what some of the pivotal events might have been that sort of pushed them forward in terms of it becoming a problem for them. And in this conversation, you're using all of your oars and using good reflections and summaries to sort of help them see it now in this mirror in a new way. So they're looking at it from this new perspective, and oftentimes after you do this, people will say, wow, you know, I hadn't really realized how much my drinking had increased over the years. Or I hadn't really realized, you know, how, you know, first I said I was just going to smoke weed because it's natural and it's not really a drug and it should be legal anyway, and, you know, but now I realize I've been using all these other drugs, and those are things that I thought I would never do. You know, and so once they start talking that way, what you're hearing is the beginning formulation in the person's mind of, gee, maybe this is a problem. You've been successful at raising doubt in their mind about, maybe I need to have a different perspective on this. Considering importance. In a minute, I'm going to show you how to do some readiness rulers. But the idea is, oftentimes people haven't quit a problematic behavior because they just don't think it's that important. And so finding out how important it is to them is an important step. As I mentioned earlier, exploring values and whether or not there's congruence between the person's values and their behavior. So I used to work in a perinatal center where we had addicted women with either who were pregnant or recently postpartum. A lot of times these women would say very strongly, you know, I want to be a good mother. That's one of the most important things to me in my life. I really want that. And so part of what we had to explore with them was, you know, take that for granted, that they really wanted that, they wanted to be a good mother. How does that fit with continuing to smoke crack? You know, and, you know, let's think through whether or not that can fit. Then there's looking forward. So this guy on tape spontaneously said, you know, gee, if I think about it and I don't change now and I think about what might happen in the future, I might end up right back here. You know, that's an example of looking forward. If you're the therapist bringing it up, you know, what you would essentially do is say, you know, considering how you're, you know, what you're doing now, let's say the drinking, considering how you're drinking now, if you imagine that you don't make any changes now and you just continue like you are, you know, what do you think is going to happen in 2 years? You know, where will you be in 5 years with that? You know, what will some of the effects be on you? And you get them to sort of project ahead, well, gee, what will happen? You know, if I continue to drink at this level, you know, might I have liver damage? Might I lose my job? Might I lose my spouse? You want them to start thinking about that. And again, this is all towards building discrepancy and eliciting change. We've already done the decisional balance, considering the pros and cons of change and the pros and cons of staying the same. So let me move to showing you the rulers, the importance of confidence rulers. All right, I'm going to draw this for you. Called a visual analog scale. So it's from 0 to 10. And essentially, it's a way of quantifying somebody, how important or confident or ready they feel about something. So let's take an example of quitting smoking. Okay. So if I'm working with a person and they're considering quitting smoking, or they're thinking about it, or maybe their doctor's told them they need to, and they don't really want to, I'm going to explore a couple of different areas using these rulers. As you see, as I do this, what you'll see is this is a great tool for documentation as well. For those of you that have to do paperwork that's onerous, you've got to document progress, you've got to document how you're checking in on goals and stuff, this is just golden. I use this in medical chart notes all the time. It's very simple. So just think about that as I'm describing it. So the question is to the patient, so on a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 being not important at all and 10 being the most important thing in your life, how important is it for you to quit smoking now? Okay, so how important is it for you to quit smoking now? So now they give you a number, right? Let's say they give you a 5. The next question is the most important part of the interview. They say, well, it's about a 5. I say, okay, it's a 5. So you're about halfway there. It's somewhat important, but it's not the most important thing in your life. Okay, that's my little reflection. Now here comes the question that's really the good question to elicit change talk. What makes it a 5 and not a 0? What makes it a 5 and not a 0? There's no way for them to answer that question without giving you change time. Okay, let me just write it up here. It's really important to get the construction of that question right. Okay. Some errors people make in trying to do this. Instead of saying what makes it, they'll say why. Don't say why. It puts people on the defensive. They feel like they have to justify it. If you say what makes it, it's just conversational. You're just trying to find out. Okay? What makes it a 5 and not a 0? And then you'll hear, well, I know that smoking is bad for me. My dad died of lung cancer. My doctor has told me that, I have hypertension. I might get a stroke if I don't quit smoking, or I might have a heart attack. They're telling you all the things. They're telling you change talk, reasons why it's important to them. Now, occasionally you'll get somebody who'll give you a very low number. They give you a 1, let's say. You still ask the question the exact same way. Okay, so it's a little tiny bit important. What makes it a 1 and not a 0? Now, I've used this technique for 14 years, and I've only ever once gotten a 0. Everybody gives me a number that's not 0 except for 1. Okay? And in that case, what did I do with that? I viewed it in my mind as resistance. I thought, okay, I'm going to reflect. So if somebody says a 0, what's your reflection here? What might you say?
How can you make this 1 or something?
I'm sorry, I can't hear the speech.
I would assume that you would want them to bring that up to a 1, and I guess the question would be asked, what do you need to do, or how would you make this a 1? I'm just fishing.
That's brilliant. That's actually the next question.
Okay.
But just to reflect, what would you do? What would you say if they really said a 0? So I said, how important is it for you to quit smoking now? 0. Exactly. You just reflect it. So right now, it feels like it's not important at all. Then the follow-up question is exactly what you said. Okay, regardless of where they are on the scale, what would it take to bring it up just 1 point? So in the case of the zero person, what would it take to bring it up to a one? In the case of the five person, what would it take to bring it up to a six? And then the treatment plan is coming out of their mouth. Okay, so this really makes your job easy. All right, so that's what she would think is important. A lot of times you get people saying, it's very important, it's an eight, it's a nine, it's a 10, okay? If that's true, that's fine, but that doesn't mean that you can take it to the bank that they're ready to change, okay? It's important, and yet, the next questions are around confidence, okay? So I'll summarize and I'll say, so right now, it's really important for you to make a change in your smoking, and you'd really like to have this change right away because you just listed 10 reasons why you're concerned about your health. So let me ask you this. How confident are you on this same scale, 0 to 10? How confident are you that you could make this change right now? Oh, well, confidence, that's only a 2. Okay, and then you see why they haven't changed yet. It's not that they don't realize it's important, and so throwing a bunch of brochures and pamphlets at them about the dangers of smoking is not going to be what you want to do in your treatment plan. Okay? Instead, you're going to want to work on skills building. You're going to want to work on building self-efficacy and confidence. So the reason I love this strategy is not only do you get a bunch of change talk and you can work with that, but also it just fills out your treatment plan for you. Determine whether it's an importance issue, meaning they need more information, they need some more doubt raised, they need awareness raised, or if it's confidence, which means they might need skills building, they might need their self-efficacy built up, they might need to remember previous successes when they were able to do something well or have a change that was difficult for them. And the same follow-up question applies. So you always ask, how important or confident are you that you can make this change now? And then, what makes it a whatever and not a zero? Okay. The other way people screw this up is they do a 1 to 10 scale, and then some smart aleck will tell you, oh, it's a zero. So always say it's a 0 to 10 scale. Okay. What makes it a 5 and not a 0 is the brilliant follow-up question that will get change talk, that desire, ability, elements of motivational interviewing, the strategies that we use to build discrepancy, that we're not just following the client wherever they want to go. We have a goal in mind for them. We want them to have a bit of discomfort about where they are. That's that discrepancy. Not so much that they're overwhelmed and will retreat from any discussion of change, and it's got to be embedded in the solid therapeutic relationship that you've built using your good reflective listening skills and the other ORs. It's client-centered because we want to focus on the client's hopes and dreams and plans. But it's directive because we are guiding the conversation around particular topics. And there are some things we're not going to delve into. They might be important in the person's life, but they don't relate to making the change that we're targeting. And so we're not going to really deal with those. We will explore the client's point of view and then over time, increasingly focus on certain parts of that point of view, which are these pieces of change talk. Does that make sense to everybody? This is what makes it a directive counseling style. So, a couple summary points here. Not only is motivational interviewing proactively using ORs and strategies to elicit change talk, but we're also getting rid of a lot of interactional style pieces that counselors from other approaches might use. It's a restrained interpersonal style. It's not full of a bunch of self-disclosure. A lot of MI counselors are very warm and personable, and yet, like Terry Moyers, who you saw on the tape with the rounder, you know, she didn't get in real deep into any of the emotional pieces. You know, she just kind of stayed on the surface of those, looking for and hearing the pieces of change talk that she could then sort of coalesce and summarize. Okay? You remain focused on the client's point of view. You listen for topics that are related to change, and then you're going to follow those topics. So there might be a whole bunch of other interesting topics. And like I said, it's not that they're irrelevant to the client's life, but they are not necessarily relevant to whether or not they can make a successful change in this target behavior. And then the counselor will elicit the mixed feelings and motivations and really, you know, work the ambivalence, really, you know, understand the ambivalence very thoroughly, and then focus in on the change talk. And that's sort of the pattern of how a session will typically go, or a couple of sessions will go over time. So, this is back to our principles, and I've got a little more detail on this slide. Express empathy, those of you trained in Rogerian client-centered, you know, techniques will recognize all the things we talked about that come right from that whole humanistic tradition, and Kharkov and Truax and people like that who have really, you know, extended Rogerian thinking. All of those good conditions where we set up a trusting relationship with therapy, you know, relate to expressing empathy, reactance, okay? So somebody tells you what to do, bosses you around, orders you around, it's very normal for you to kind of get your back up and be frustrated by that and maybe argue back, and that's what we're trying to avoid. So one reason we don't confront head on is we want to minimize psychological reactance. Also, self-perception theory, and in your handouts, I'll have a couple slides describing a little more about that, indicates that essentially we persuade ourselves to change. So just like the college debaters whose political perspectives moved in favor of the one they were arguing for, even when they had strongly held positions previous to that, when we get people to talk about what they're going to do, why they should do it, how they're going to do it, in fact, those things tend to happen. So again, the more commitment talk you get from somebody, the more self-persuasion talk, well, gee, I really do need to consider this. You know, this is more of a problem than I realized. I'd really like to get rid of some of these problems related to my drinking. The more you hear that, the more what you're hearing is the person is persuading themselves to change. They're arguing in favor of change for themselves. And then it's just up to you to underline the heck out of it by reflecting, paraphrasing, exploring, you know, really making sure they hear themselves, persuading themselves. In terms of developing discrepancy, the key idea is the dissonance, the difference between where you are and where you'd like to be, what your values are and how you're actually living, you know, and that discomfort about where you are now and the fact that it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like where you want to be. And the last bullet point there is the last principle of motivation reviewing, which is support self-efficacy, which we haven't really talked about yet. The idea here is self-efficacy is a special form of confidence. Okay, it's confidence that you can do a specific behavior. So, you know, I might have strong self-efficacy that I can park in a parking space at my building, and weaker self-efficacy that I can parallel park on the streets of New Orleans. Okay, so it's confidence about a specific skill that the person has, or a specific thing that they can do. Now, the more people feel confident that they can do something, in fact, all Bandura's research showed that that was strongly related to whether they would subsequently try to make the change or try to do the behavior, and whether they would be successful at it, right? So again, all that basic Psych 101 stuff from the 70s showed that if you have strong expectancies of success, you're more likely to give it a shot, and you're more likely to succeed. So part of what we want to do strategically in motivational interviewing is harness the power of expectancy. Help the person think through other things in their life that they've been successful at. It might be that it's true that they've never quit using drugs, or they've never quit smoking, okay? But that doesn't mean they've never done anything that they've been proud of that was hard to achieve and that they had to persevere at and that they had to try. And so, you know, even in cases where the person has been using since they were, you know, preteen, you can always find something that they're confident about or proud about that was a skill that they had to learn that maybe they had some doubts about at first, but then they were able to master it. And so one way to support self-efficacy is to help them remember those successes, you know, and then say, well, gee, you know, you told me this long story about how, you know, you learned to cook for your family and, you know, now you're really seen as, you know, the best cook in the family and that's a source of pride for you. You know, are there some things that you can learn from the process of how you got there that we might be able to use in this situation where you're trying to, you know, quit smoking or you're trying to, you know, start exercising or whatever the target behavior is. So the idea is you're going to increase their confidence in a specific behavior and then you're going to increase the likelihood that they're going to try it. The other caution I have about that is for people to really develop confidence, they usually have to take small steps over time that will build towards success. So if someone has never gone for 24 hours without using, I'm not going to see them one week and give them some assignment or even, you know, agree with the assignment they give themselves that they're going to not use for the whole week until they see me next. Okay? I'm probably going to say, well, why don't we start with a small achievable goal? You know, what do you think would be a reasonable amount of time that you could not use, you know, in the next few days? What do you think that would be? You know, and I might start really small. I might say, you think you could go 6 hours? Oh, I could definitely go 6 hours. You know, sometimes I have to go 6 hours because I can't get it, you know. But okay, well, what do you think would be a reasonable amount of time? And maybe I'll negotiate with them for, you know, 24 hours. Then they have the opportunity to come back in and see me next time and say, guess what? I was able to do it. I went the 24 hours, but then I used the rest of the days. Okay? I'm going to still see that as a success, and so are they. And they're going to feel good about it, and they're not going to avoid telling me about the rest of what they've been doing. So then you're going to reflect like crazy, you know, on how they're feeling and what the success was like and how did they do it, and, you know, really try to emphasize that. And then say, okay, so what's the next step? And let them come up with it. You know, your job is to elicit from them not only the arguments for change, but how are they going to get there? Okay, a couple of other key points. So MI is a style, counseling style, has features that it shares with other brief therapy approaches, and as I've talked about it the last 2 days, you've probably heard lots of things that are pieces of other counseling approaches you've been trained to use. From my perspective, it draws on a couple of theories and approaches heavily. So person-centered or client-centered approach, obviously. It's also cognitive, and so sometimes people say, well, can I use motivational interviewing with everybody? And my answer to that is, you know, there are probably some subpopulations where this is not going to work as well because it actually requires the person to be able to do some hypothetical thinking, you know, some meta thinking. And so if this is a person who really has very limited intellect or has maybe had some kind of brain injury and has some cognitive impairments or is actively delusional or psychotic, you know, this might not work as well. Just because it requires some cognitive capacity for the person to really work it through in words with you. It also draws on systems and reality therapies because we are asking people to really focus in on specific behaviors, on, you know, how things operate in their real world. You know, we're not doing an extensive cognitive behavioral behavior chain analysis or anything, but we're drawing on some of those techniques. And decisional balance actually comes from some problem-solving theory in cognitive behavioral therapy. And social psychology concepts of persuasion. So things we learned in the 60s and 70s from social psychology about how people make changes on their own, not in the pathological realm or in the disorder realm, but just general. You know, psychological reactants, cognitive dissonance, self-perception theory, where we persuade ourselves to make change. All of those things are sort of underpinnings of motivational learning. And another piece is that we really assume that motivation is not an inherent and unchanging trait of the person. It's something that we can influence. And there's a lot of evidence of that. So I'll tell you one story related to that. There was a study, again, by social psychologists in the 70s. We were looking at an alcohol treatment program. And they were trying to figure out, were there ways to predict who would be successful and who would not in terms of the patients in that program? And so they gave the patients all a big battery of tests, you know, intellectual tests and personality tests and that kind of stuff. And then they observed the patients over time, and they tracked their outcome, okay? Now, they told the counselors in this program, all right, we've identified a subset of patients who we think are really going to do great in the program, and we're going to call these people high alcoholism recovery potential folks, the HARPs, okay? They are the ones who are really likely to do great, and they're going to have the best outcomes, and, you know, our tests have shown us this. These other people, they didn't show up to be HARPs, and so they're not going to do so well in the treatment. Well, what happened is exactly what they predicted. Those who were identified as HARPs did well. They were maximally involved, they participated, they stopped using, they ended up mentoring and sponsoring others, they had everything you would want for somebody who makes a really a big turnaround in their life. And the other folks had more mixed results. Some of them did okay and some of them didn't. Now the punchline was that in fact, the reason that they did the testing was just to make sure that all the patients were the same. There was no such thing as a HARP profile or as a non-HARP profile. The only difference was that the counselors were told that the HARPs were HARPs, and therefore what was being manipulated was the counselors' expectancies. Now, nowadays, we would never do an experiment like this because of ethical concerns, okay? Back then, they were able to do that study. But what it tells me is counselor expectancies have a lot to do with what's ultimately going to happen. So what do you think caused that difference in treatment outcome? I mean, why would the treatment outcome be different for the HARPs and the non-HARPs?
It's how the counselors their reaction, the whole approach.
Yes, yeah, so they must have done
they
something different.
Too much, I mean, thought, you know,
that's right. So you know, again, just sort of like a teacher's pet thing. You know, the teacher's pet always does great because they're getting a lot of attention, they're getting a lot of praise, they're feeling like they're involved and they're a part of things. And, you know, it's probably a whole bunch of those kinds of factors that happened. But really, the bottom line is, you know, we have to watch our own expectancies because they're very powerful. So if you have a negative attitude about a patient or if you think, oh, you know, this is going nowhere, you kind of seal their fate.
Well, and also, in that same study, the counselors would have had a stress put on them. If I know a non-HARP person is coming in to me, I'm instantly going to feel like, okay, I've got to be working harder on this one.
Right, right. And you might, in fact, try to overcome the odds and beat the odds, but some counselors might just give up and say, oh, you know, they're not going to do it anyway. So, you know, I'm just going to let them go through the motions and, you know, maybe you wouldn't invest quite as much. I don't know. They weren't able to investigate exactly why those outcomes happened, but it's very notable how strong the effect was, you know, just by the way that they labeled the patients. So that's really evidence that motivation, you know, is influenceable, that it's a state, that it's not just that somebody comes in unmotivated. And as I said yesterday, you know, they're motivated for something. It might not be the thing you want them to be motivated for in that moment. They are motivated for something. And then the other thing is we assume that if we look at ambivalence, we accept ambivalence, we actively explore it, we make a target of the treatment, that is going to help us to get a lot more context-specific knowledge of the patient, really be able to be more precise in helping them figure out what they need to do to make a healthy change for themselves, or even if now is the time. Now, one possible outcome of motivational interviewing is that the person, you know, in collaboration with you, comes to the decision that now is not the time that they want to make this change. You know, and as I said a minute ago, that's not seen as a failure in motivational interviewing. You know, it may be that for a number of good reasons, they are not ready to change. We're not giving up. We're not labeling them in a pejorative way. We're saying, you know, the door is always open. If you think it's going to be helpful to come back, I'll be happy to see you. But I hear you that right now, this is not the highest priority for you. Does that make sense to everybody? How are we doing on time? 10 more minutes? All right, before we wrap up, has everyone signed in and given me your email? Is there anybody that we're missing? All right. That to some degree we want to match what we do with our patients to their level of readiness. And one language for that readiness is stages of change. How many of you are familiar with the concept of stages of change? Okay, most everyone. So the idea is that in the smoking literature and in the psychotherapy literature, researchers were able to identify these stages that people seem to move through when they were making natural change over time. And the idea is also that maybe we can increase the speed at which people move through these stages if we're giving them some kind of treatment. And so the stages are pre-contemplation, where somebody's not really considering making change right now. That doesn't mean they're stubborn, it could also mean they're just demoralized. So this is where you see a lot of smokers or old heroin addicts. You know, they feel like they've tried for many years and they can't change, and so they'd like to change but they can't, so they're not planning to. Contemplation, this is where we've got people who are in that exquisitely balanced ambivalence. So, you know, they'd like to think about maybe making a change, they're considering it, but they've not committed, and there's good reasons on both sides. Good reasons to stay the same, good reasons to in preparation, people within the next month, next 30 days, are planning to make a change. This is where somebody maybe who needs to go on a diet says, well, after I eat all that junk food up on the fridge, then I'm going to go on a diet. Then I'm only going to eat lettuce, okay? I'm going to eat all those Doritos, and then I'm only eating lettuce. Or the smoker who says, when I finish this carton, I'm quitting. I'm not buying anymore, okay? That's an example of preparation. All right. Action is when, for at least one day, the person has changed the behavior. So if it's something they're trying to get rid of, a habit they're trying not to do, they haven't done it for a full day. If it's something they're trying to do, they've done the new thing for at least one day. The way I view action is, it's great when somebody gets into action, but the emotional impact of action usually is a sense of struggle. it's a struggle. The person is still struggling, you know. If they're trying to exercise every day, you know, 15 minutes or something, you know, they have to force themselves to do it. They don't really want to do it. Oh, it's going to be hot and sweaty. I don't want to do it. You know, I don't want to put on my gym shoes. You know, it's a struggle. They have to talk themselves into it every single time. Or if they're giving something up, you know, I don't want that cigarette, but boy, would it really taste good, and I have a headache, and I'm grouchy, and, you know, they're struggling. That stage usually lasts about 6 months. Sometimes a little shorter, sometimes a little longer, but the struggle you'll hear as it starts to diminish over time. And then the person may move into maintenance, or they may move into relapse, where they go back to the previous behavior. In maintenance, the person has been doing the new behavior or getting rid of the old bad behavior for at least 6 months. And it's no longer seeming like a struggle. They can sort of put it on the back burner. And so it's not quite as difficult for them anymore. In relapse, the person has returned to the previous behavior that they're trying to get rid of or trying to do. And yet, most people who relapse don't recycle all the way back to pre-contemplation, meaning not planning to change. They tend to go back into contemplation or preparation. And the good thing about that is they're able to then use some of what they learned through this past attempt to change that didn't work out to try to inform the next change attempt. So the research shows that most people go through 3 to 7 serious change attempts before they're able to make the final change. So if you want to be the best therapist in your agency, you want to get that person on the 5th or 6th try. Because your success rates are going to look really good, you know. Now that would be a little counterintuitive because you may think, oh, you know, this is a retread, this is a repeat offender, you know. But I'm inviting you to consider how natural change occurs, and in fact, you may have a great opportunity. And given how important our expectancies are, I think we need to reframe how we view those folks who are continually showing up in our agencies. So what I have on this list here is sort of, at each stage, what do you do as a counselor? What are some of the tasks that you have that can be helpful to the person? And so pre-contemplation, you're really just going to raise doubt and increase their possibility of having a different perception about the issue. In contemplation, you're trying to tip that decisional balance, you know, and get a different response from this. In preparation, you're really planning. You're planning for change. Change hadn't happened yet. You're making a plan, you're helping them debrief. Like Terry Moyers at the Rounder said, well, if you were to stop drinking, what would get in the way? And that's when you heard that story about these guys who go out to the bunker and they throw each other in the lake and all that, you know, that he didn't want to be, like, you know, called a wimp by his friends. You know, that's part of it. So you debrief the barriers. In action, this is where you might move into other forms of treatment that you might already have in your agency, you know. You might have some 12-step facilitation kind of treatment. You might have cognitive behavioral treatment that are more action-oriented. And it's fine to move from a motivational interviewing approach to one of those other approaches, and they can fit very well together. And then in maintenance, oftentimes there are identity issues that need to be addressed. That, you know, the person now has a new identity. You know, it's not that they are, you know, an ex-smoker. They're a non-smoker. It's not that they're divorced, now they're single. They define themselves in a different way. They no longer define themselves around the old problem. And then in relapse, of course, you're trying to help them recycle through those stages more quickly. And, you know, from my clinical experience, I think that motivational interviewing techniques are really the most helpful in the first 3 stages of change, those pre-contemplator, contemplator, preparer folks. And those are about 80% of the clients who come into treatment. So I think motivational interviewing has a lot of utility. And really what we've done in these last 2 days is just give you a taste of what this looks like, give you a little bit of practice with it, a little bit of familiarity with it. It is one of those things that if you are willing to sort of listen to yourself and look at the skills and look at, you know, what's really happening in the sessions, you know, you can increase your own knowledge and skills with it pretty rapidly, not necessarily having to go to a bunch of training. But I do encourage you, there are some resources I'll show you if you want to learn more. See, I have a whole bunch of slides. resources. Let me just point out that MI website has all of this on there, okay? MI website is motivationalinterview.org. Has all the publications that have ever been published on motivational interviewing, has links to all the resources. If you like some of the DVDs that I show or other tapes, they're all available on the website, or they link to where you can get them. It's a great resource. Motivational Interview book is in the second edition, came out just a couple years ago. And there's also, if you do more work with health behavior change or medical populations, there's a health behavior change book. Walnick and his colleagues are coming out with a new guide for health practitioners this coming year. So there's going to be some more resources. But the best single resource is the Motivational Interview website, and you can get all kinds of information and resources for you if you want to continue your learning. It's Eric.